it's been 3.5 years since crowds in Tahrir Square brought an end to Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's rule. Since then, discussions of an Arab Spring have faded from the headlines, and the future of representative government throughout the Middle East is in doubt. Our next guest says, though, the 20-somethings who filled the streets and squares around the Middle East haven't gone anywhere, and he says that generation still wants the same things it demanded back in 2011. Juan Cole shares a more or less optimistic take on the aftermath of the Arab Spring in his new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Juan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, with what's happened in a place like Egypt since January of 2011, the Muslim Brotherhood winning an election, then widespread violence, what many call a military coup, restoring the army to power, does this story still apply, the story of young Arabs demanding and maybe achieving democracy?
Well, I think it's too early to tell. The young Arabs wanted more than just democracy. They wanted social justice, and they, above all, wanted an end to Presidents for Life and the prospect that the Presidents for Life were going to be succeeded by their sons, a kind of return to a dynastic principle within the Arab republics. And that was happening in Egypt, in Libya, in Yemen, in Tunisia and so forth, and they stopped it. I mean, that's one of the big things that that happened in 2011 was that the whole idea of the president for life and the succession within that family of presidents for life, that's on the trash heap of history.
And you say the responsibility for that win, that change, lies with these millennial generation Arabs. Why did they play such a central role?
Well, they just weren't going to take it anymore. The elders have told me that they were afraid. They were divided. They had gotten used to the situation. They had been convinced that nothing could be done. Many of them emigrated to the West out of despair. But these young 20-somethings believed that things could change and that they could make them change. And they were willing to make pragmatic, broad-based alliances to accomplish it. So the elders view them as generationally quite distinct in their attitudes and in their organizational prowess.
So what is it about this millennial generation in the Arab world that is so distinct from previous generations? What set them apart before we got to the Arab Spring?
They're much more urban than their parents or grandparents. You go back to the late 60s in Libya, and 80% of people were farmers, and they were out in the rural areas. It's now the reverse. Most people in Libya are living in cities. But, of course, the older of them weren't brought up in cities. These young people have been. So they're very urban. The post-colonial states that came into being with the end of colonialism after World War II were very big on universal education, and they set up vast school systems and hired teachers and went out into villages. So this young generation is nearly universally literate. They can read and write. They read newspapers, and then they're wired. They're on the internet. They watch satellite TV. Many of them have worked abroad. They're cosmopolitan, so they just have much wider horizons than their parents or grandparents who grew up in small villages.
And it seems important to note there are a lot of them. These are very young countries in terms of average age. The millennials are a baby boom, in a way.
Absolutely. The population of Egypt has doubled since 1980, and it's the mean population of the Arab world, half of people under it, half of people over it, is 24. So the millennials, the people born between the late 1970s and the year 2000 or so, are over a third of the whole population.
And you focus on Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia for the most part in your book. What was the economic life like for millennials in those countries?
Well, you had very large numbers of people turning 18 or 22 every year who wanted a job, and these economies were not very good at providing the jobs. Ironically, they were even less good at providing jobs to educated youth than they were to people willing to do menial labor. And so if you had a BA, 30% of people highly educated were unemployed. The economies were sclerotic. They did have some growth spurts here and there, but they simply weren't attracting foreign investment at a very high level. In fact, the Arab world is among the worst in the world on the statistics for direct foreign investment. That's held them back. Then I think they lied. That is to say, you know, Tunisia reported 5% a year growth from the 1990s forward. I've been to Tunisia. I've been to other countries that had that kind of growth, and it doesn't look to me as though that could possibly be true. And it's also very suspicious. It's kind of a Madoff curve, 5% a year over a decade. So I think they weren't actually growing, and many Tunisian youth were forced to go to Europe for work. And so their economic situation was very bad, and that was one of the reasons they were so dissatisfied.
So you have this large cohort, not a lot of jobs, a bad economy. They're urban, literate, wired. They're facing a corrupt government that looks like it's going to become, in effect, a presidential monarchy. Was something like this going to happen, whether it was a Tunisian street vendor setting himself on fire or something else? Do you think it was inevitable that something was going to trigger this kind of widespread revolt?
Yes, I think, given the situation, that this was a tinderbox and anything could have set it off. These regimes were cartel regimes. They were being ruled by a kind of cronyism. So, you know, a lot of them had socialist tendencies back in the Cold War in the 60s and 70s. They modeled themselves to some extent on the East Bloc. But then from the 90s forward, after the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the East Bloc, there was pressure from the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, from Washington, Paris, and London, to privatize. But the problem is that if you have a president for life and he's presiding over an economy, half of which is in government hands, when it starts to privatize, there's an opportunity there for insider trading of a vast sort, because the ruling family knows what's going to be put on the block and where the good buying opportunities are, and they can call up their relatives or their close friends and make billionaires of them. And so that was what was being done. It was very corrupt, and that kind of corruption, you know, discourages foreign corporations from investing. Probably cut a point to 3 points a year off of growth. And so these youth saw these regimes as a huge old dam in the way of the progress of their generation, and they were determined to blow it up.
Well, fast forward a few years, they did, in fact, blow it up. Those particular regimes are gone now. When these millennials, and I'm sure there's a lot of diversity here, but in general, when they're talking about politics, are they looking back and saying mission accomplished, or are they looking ahead saying here's what we haven't achieved yet?
Oh, the youth are very dissatisfied. I mean, nothing pleases them. They don't feel like they've accomplished what they set out to do at all, but they haven't given up. Probably the best transition we've seen is in Tunisia, where you had elections, you crafted a new constitution, there was a lot of compromise between the Muslim and the secular forces, and you've had a transition now to a technocratic caretaker government, which will oversee new elections. So, you know, from the political science literature and the experience of various countries with these kinds of transitions from a dictatorship to a democracy, you really couldn't ask for much better performance than Tunisia. But the Tunisians are all convinced that it's been a horror show and a complete catastrophe, and they're very upset with how things are going. So no, they're not resting on their laurels.
We're talking to Juan Cole. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan. His newest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We're back with Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. You can join the conversation with your questions, your thoughts on the topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Juan, you make an analogy at one point to the Prague Spring, this uprising in Czechoslovakia in 1968. Looks like ultimately a failure, but then look forward a couple decades and the people leading that are running the place. Do you expect similar things from this generation in the Arab world, that governments will look very different when they take their experiences from the last few years and are in charge?
Yes. Well, one of the things we can confidently predict is that the current 60-somethings, who many of whom are uncomfortable with these youth revolutions and who have pushed back, they're not going to be in power in 20 or 30 years. They're not even going to be among us. Whereas the 20-somethings in 20 or 30 years are going to be taking over. And while it is true that we can't be sure what their values will be at that point, the likelihood is that many of them will remain committed to the ideals for which they have fought, and those ideals are likely to be powerful and to have a shaping effect down the road.
One thing you point to in all three countries you write about is the egalitarian or sort of horizontal organization of protest movements among the youth. You referenced one of your colleagues saying something like, "Take me to your leader," and getting funny looks from protesters. Is that, do you think, going to shape the way they protest in years to come and maybe the way they exercise political power?
Yes, they haven't, you know, it's not that they don't have leaders or that they don't have respect for leaders, but they, for the most part, they really prefer to organize themselves in networks. For that reason, one of the little noticed outcomes of these 2011 and after events has been an explosion of NGOs, of non-governmental organizations, many of them almost exclusively staffed by 20-somethings and 30-somethings. They simply didn't exist, you know, in the zeros in the last decade. In a place like Libya, there were no NGOs. And now there are literally thousands of them, and they do all kinds of things from charity to culture kinds of work. And so a lot of the energies of this generation seem to be put into that kind of more egalitarian organization. They're so far not very into political parties, and this is maybe a fault in them, but that's where we are.
Now, you focused on the best-case outcomes for these millennial youth protesters. There are other countries where things didn't come out that way, places like Qatar, where they were quelled by authoritarian governments, places like Yemen, where there was kind of a negotiated change of power, but not really meeting as many of their demands as elsewhere. But are there lessons that might apply to those places in the future that might have a different outcome?
Well, I should just underline that what I was studying was the youth movements, was movements of these young people that conceived themselves as being for the youth and trying to achieve their aspirations, express their grievances. So I didn't really make my choice of which countries to look at by outcomes, but by whether they had these big youth movements. And it just so happens that a place like Yemen is very rural. And while it did have a youth movement, it's maybe not the most important thing going on in that country. But certainly these movements were networked throughout the Arab world, to some extent internationally as well, but very tightly within among the Arab world. They gave each other advice. They debated tactics, ideals. And I think they had a broad influence. And I think one of the big takeaways is where regimes have been flexible enough to accommodate the basic demands of these youth movements, then things have gone all right. Haven't been paradise, but there's been a relatively soft landing. Where the regimes dug in and just refused to give an inch and were willing to deploy their military to resist the demands of the networked youth, it often has turned to civil war, or there's been a kind of repression that can't possibly be good for the economy or the society in the long run. And here one thinks of Syria. Even in Iraq, there was a kind of Sunni Arab Spring among young people in Fallujah and Mosul, which the government just crushed. And after they did that, people lost hope, and now terrorists have taken over. So the next time there's a set of big demonstrations by young people in these countries, I'd advise the rulers to find a way to compromise rather than rolling tanks and trying to put them down, because militarizing this kind of social conflict rips the society apart.
You mentioned terrorism. A lot of the worry in the Western world is that disaffected young people, maybe millennials in particular, will want to turn toward religious parties or religious-affiliated parties like the Muslim Brotherhood-supported political parties in Egypt, or to terrorist groups maybe as extreme as ISIS. Is there a competition almost between the sort of, I think we call it a leftist protesting we've been talking about, and drawing people into terrorist organizations?
Well, there is a big divide among the youth of the Arab world between what I call the new left and those who favor the religious right. And there's a further divide within the religious right between people who favor peaceful and parliamentary procedures and those who are willing to pick up a gun. So the new left is too often, in my view, discounted or unknown in Western analysis, whereas in a place like urban Egypt, I think it's predominant. And it certainly was the leading edge of the 2011 revolutions. This is true in Tunisia as well. It's true in Yemen. One forgets now that Marxism and other forms of leftist thought had powerful purchase in much of the Arab world. In fact, you had South Yemen was communist for years and for decades. And the Communist Party in Iraq at one point really amounted to something. And these leftist movements, leftist parties are gone or very weak. But I argue that there's kind of millions and millions of red diaper babies in the Arab world who have leftist tendencies, who sympathize with workers and worker rights, and sympathize with farmers and the difficulties they face now with global warming and water shortages, and despite being urban. There's a kind of middle-class youth link to factory workers and farmers. This is a big, important political complex in many of these countries, which we just don't hear so much about. And in a place like Tunisia, you know, the people who support a terrorist organization like Ansar al-Sharia are just a very tiny group. Now, they can make a lot of trouble because they have guns, and so forth, but they're just not demographically important, and none of those kinds of people, you know, did well in the elections that were held. In Egypt now, not only have those kinds of radicals been crushed, but even the mainstream Muslim Brotherhood certainly is not a terrorist organization, even though the generals consider it one. There's an attempt to crush it as well, but I don't imagine that the core, you know, constituency for the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is more than 10 or 20%. So I think we have, you know, a little bit of a distorted view of the region, in the sense that the people with the guns make a big splash, and one hears a lot about them. But the young kind of democratic socialists of the region, it seems to me, are really much more mainstream.
In past flare-ups between Israelis and Palestinians, that has definitely influenced politics elsewhere in the Arab world. How do you see that affecting millennial politics, the youth movements that you're talking about this time around?
Well, the Arab millennials, like Arabs in general, have a great deal of sympathy with the Palestinians in general and object to how they perceive them to be being treated by the Israelis. But in these revolutions, for the most part, they declined to make those foreign policy issues central to their protests. I've been in Egypt on a number of occasions since 2011, and in 2011, and in the summer of 2011, there was a month-long Tahrir Square, downtown Cairo, set of enormous protests in July of that year. And I went down there every day and took pictures of placards and talked to people. And I didn't see a single poster or piece of graffiti that referred to the United States or Israel.
Juan, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That's Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. His new book is The New Arabs: How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East.